On FM, digital and your mobile, Cambridge 105 Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour. Our thanks to Tony Barnfield. And now it's an hour of food and drink with Alan Alder, Dr. Sue Bailey and myself, Matt Bentman. Sitting in with us is Grace Kempling.
Today we find out about two new Cambridge restaurants, Parker's Tavern and Restaurant 22.
Tina Roche and Liz Young of Cambridge Cookery and Alex Rushmer, peripatetic chef about town, talk about food. We see how Allotment Cafe is getting on after 2 years in business, and Dave Fox will be warning of a new insect pest that's gradually taking hold and has advice on preparing your seed beds.
And we have the usual news from Cambridge food tweeters and what's available for nothing via the Olio app.
On our last programme, we spoke with Tristan Welch, Chef Director of Parker's Tavern in the University Arms Hotel. He talked about working with Gordon Ramsay, Marcus Waring and Michel Roux Jr. Today, Tristan talks about what Parker's Tavern will be like and what's on the menu.
Vision is a great big buzzy brasserie that's embracing British food, Cambridge eccentricity, local ingredients, and just deliciousness. And in fact, one of the first sayings we had when we were working out the vision of the restaurant was a delicious taste of Cambridge. A restaurant is a wonderful thing, and you know I've been very lucky to work in some of the best restaurants in the world, possibly, and slightly got disconnected from a restaurants in along the way, sort of thing. And why I loved restaurants. So Parker's Tavern is everything I love about a restaurant, everything I think a restaurant should be. It should be fun, it should be exciting, it should be warm and friendly with the most delicious food.
Good. Well, we're very pleased to hear it. And I suppose you've been spending time actually trying to source delicious food and agree prices and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So we've been spending a lot of time focusing on the quality of produce that we're going to be buying in and the locality of it, and because we wanted to make it a real regional taste. I think it's really important that we take local produce, we embrace it, and we create something wonderful from it, and that defines our menu to a certain degree.
On the website, when I looked, I think it was probably yesterday, actually, it said, well, there wasn't a menu there. It said it was about to appear or something. Any idea when it's going to appear, or can you give us any examples of what might be on it yet?
Yeah. I'm not going to show you a full leg. I'll show you a little bit of heel, you know. Do you know what? We've been very, very lucky. We've had a month in the kitchen developing dishes, and it starts with fidget pie, Huntingdon fidget pie. So that's real traditional sort of farmer's dish. We've taken the lovely ingredients of bacon, onions and apple, which is the basis of the of fidget pie. We've made it into a hand-raised pork pie we'll carve at the table or sort of thing. And I've got to say, it's delicious, it's striking, it's real theatre. It's reasonable. It comes out at a reasonable price. We'll be able to serve something really delicious to a lot of people, which will be great. And that's just a fidget pie. There's loads more. You know, we've got a beautiful baked sole with brown shrimps and samphire and epicure potatoes, which is like those lovely sort of new potatoes and all that sort of stuff. Local asparaguses. Gosh, you know, I can go on forever. Oh, God, the other day we did a chicken tikka pie because we thought, what a great British dish. Why don't we make it into a pie? And so chicken tikka pie will feature on our menu.
Let's finish by talking about wine.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the great pleasures is the wine that just matches the meal so well, I think. What are you doing about that? I mean, is there a cellar at the University Arms of you know, some distinction, or have you had to build it up?
There's currently no cellar at the University Arms, but we have a space for it. So I think it's got builders in at the moment. We are starting off with a small, very thoughtful wine list, and this is one of the joys of opening a restaurant. Mm. And I think I've been quite real about it and saying, OK, we're starting off with a small wine list that's very thoughtful and full of things which are just completely delicious. But a good wine list is something that grows over years. And we've just got this wine, it's not drinking great right now, let's lay it down for a year sort of thing. Mm. And I am very happy to ensure we go on that journey before we start buying these wines we know nothing about, and you've got a great book of wines which you know little about. I'd rather buy 50, 60 bottles, and we've all had a little taste of them all. Actually, to be honest, we tried to taste them all last week and we couldn't do it. It was just insane. I have to say, but what a pleasure to try.
If you ever need any help.
Yeah. It's about growth, I think, and about actually going along that sort of wineless journey. But on the other hand, University Arms does have a history of bottling its own wine. So we've last year commissioned our own claret to be bottled, and it's bottled now. We're just waiting to put the label on and then stock it.
Yeah. And the markup of wine, I think, is a controversial point. And with apps like Vigneau, people can take a photograph of the label and see what the markup is.
Well, first of all, I think life's too short to drink bad wine. So, and I believe the more money you spend, the less markup it should be. It's another one occasionally, you know, or maybe the waiter drops it, you know, it doesn't matter. But there's a lot of other costs that go into it. It is the whole thing about Parker's Tavern is it's great food, great wine at great value. And believe me, I have been tirelessly tasting away for the past year and a half trying to find the perfect bottle of wine for the perfect price.
Well, somebody's got to do it. Right, tell us roughly when's it going to open?
Roughly this summer.
Right, so that
when's
could
it
be
going out next year? No, I mean we were due to open last year. With these projects, you just never know, and it's being such an old historic building, we are looking at June, hopefully.
Right. Well,
but watch this space, or listen to this space.
Yes, we'll look forward to it greatly. Thank you very much, Tristan.
Thank you. Cheers.
And that was Tristan Welch of Parker's Tavern. And Tristan is cooking this weekend at the Michael House Cafe, tonight being the second night of his pop-up with Alex Rushmer. I'm going along and I must say I'm really looking forward to it.
Mm. Fantastic.
Now, here's the first of what we're planning to be a fairly regular feature. Cambridge Cookery and Bistro on Purbeck Road, that's just off Hills Road. It's run by Tina Roche and her business partner Liz Young. They will be inviting a culinary guest in to chat about their food heritage, their memories, their influences.
Their first guest is chef and food writer Alex Rushmer. Both Tina and Alex are from Sweden. Although Alex was raised in England, he spent his holidays there, whilst Liz is from New Zealand. This first outing focuses on Scandinavian foods, as well as wild food and foraging, and a dish they'll try together. Here's Alex.
My memory of Swedish holidays is wrapped up entirely around food. The other thing that I love about it is just how communal it all is as well. There's a real sense of a shared experience with the Swedish celebratory holidays.
Oh yes, you know, the herrings are always there, obviously, and preserved and cured foods. You know, we're very fond of our foraging and our wild food still.
Yeah, I think this is a product of Sweden being so far north and the harshness of the winters in Scandinavia and how little fresh produce is available, and that sort of culinary tradition that lends itself very well to curing and pickling and preserving. You need to make the bounty of summer last through the autumn and the winter.
Mm. And I think so many of the flavours that we all like, including Liz, is almost Japanese in its sort of sweet and sourness, and, you know, using pickling vinegars. And our Scandinavians really are the kings and queens of curing and pickling, but absolutely out of necessity.
I think there's a real Scandinavian and Japanese food is two culinary cultures that are very, very similar. Would you find that from the Antipodes as well? Do you think there's this tradition of having to make the bounty of summer last through the colder months?
I think it's less pickling and curing at home. I think that we smoke a lot, but because our coastline isn't as harsh as Northern Europe, it goes cold, but they never stop going out fishing. But it does play a major role in everyone's lives, and it's cheap. Mm. Anyone can go fishing at home, so it's a good way of feeding your family and you're getting good nutrition.
You know, I have my happiest memories on the water in Sweden, in the archipelago, going out in just someone's small boat with a little outboard engine, catching fish from the boat. And we were allowed out from a very early age, from sort of 7 or 8, alone in a boat, which you probably wouldn't do to a child these days. It was a good lesson in treating food with respect, but also having to get on with killing the fish you'd caught with no adults there to help you.
I recall our summer holidays were always spent at the beach down on the coast on the Coromandel, and we would generally every single day go and dig for mussels and pippies and cockles, and then you'd come home, you'd soak them, and you'd put them on the barbecue for dinner. Dipped in vinegar.
Ooh. So we thought we'd try a traditional approach to wild food. So we've got a bit of venison in front of us from a supplier I know both we and you, Alex, like, which is Radwinter Wild Food down in Essex, just south of Cambridge.
And is venison a meat that you would find in Sweden?
Oh, very much so, yes. I mean, we have an issue with it, with too many of them. They're everywhere, they're in people's gardens, and they're a complete menace, of course, as I'm sure most people with them around them here would agree, but they do have the most fantastic meat. You know, they've obviously just been grazing wild food. They taste fantastic. It's incredibly lean.
We have massive deer farms at home and around Taupo. My partner actually loves hunting, so he goes out into the mountains and he will shoot a deer and bring it home. Takes it to the local butcher and he'll turn it into all different parts.
Do you think that it's that a very immediate connection is something that's important?
I think so. And I mean, for him, he loves going out and having the peace of being in the bush, and it's fresh. And he's not killing for the sake of killing, it's killing to eat.
Yeah.
For me, it's important to remember that they've had a natural and very happy life till the very end, rather than the dismal story of farmed animals. So, you know, I think we should all eat more wild meat. And it's good for us, it's very lean and delicious. I think in this country, venison is often associated with sort of stews and slow cooking and using the less tender parts of the animal and using the fillet, as we have in this case, the loin. Like any prime cuts, the less you cook it, the better it is, really. Yeah. So our approach to this is that we haven't cooked it at all. It's mostly like a carpaccio. So it's been cured in salt and sugar, and we usually put in rosemary, some rose pepper and juniper, bay leaves, juniper, yeah.
Venison and juniper is an amazing combination. Juniper is so Scandinavian as well. Wild juniper grows all over the place throughout Sweden.
And somehow it just enhances the flavour of game, doesn't it? Oddly, it just seems to go with it.
Yeah, it has a natural affinity though with wild food. And there's a really nice little adage, which is, if it grows together, it goes together.
Absolutely.
And this is a prime example of that.
Yeah, it is. We're combining it with a remoulade, which is, you know, we use our homemade mayonnaise, just put a little bit of curry powder in and finely chopped silver skin onions and gherkins. And it just has a lovely flavour, which also goes very well with fried fish, by the way, and some crispy frazzled onions. So you get these lovely colours on the plate of dark crimson red meat and the yellow remoulade, and then these lovely little golden pieces of onion that add a bit of crunch and texture to it. It's a lovely dish that we often use as a starter here in the bistro. That is lovely, isn't it? Such a lovely texture. The meat is so tender. So what are your food memories then, mainly from Scandinavia, Alex?
My friends were always... I think when you're a child, what you don't get on a daily basis suddenly becomes something that you yearn for. And Mum always used to cook Swedish food, and my friends were always keen to come over and have Swedish meatballs and lingonberry and mashed potato and salmon and all these things that were suddenly very exotic. Mm. And for me, it was everyday food and a lot of boiled potatoes,
yes.
Boiled carrots. But my friends were always so keen to come over and eat, and I was always so keen to go over and eat potato waffles and beans and,
yeah.
and sausages. And I remember feeling almost embarrassed because the food that we had at home was so different to the food that all my friends ate growing up. And my mum made me packed lunches, and I used to take my packed lunches, and it was sandwiches with smoked salmon. And I was like 6 years old eating these things, and I felt very out of place. I'm very grateful for it now. In retrospect, it was, you know, that education is so important. There's certain Swedish flavours that take some getting used to, and if you don't grow up with them... I was probably 19 years old before I enjoyed the taste of herring.
Mm.
It's something that's very strong. It can be quite pungent. It can be quite aggressive, and it is an acquired taste. And anchovies as well. If you think about Jansson's temptation, Jansson's temptation is now one of my absolute favourite dishes.
Mm.
It's essentially a potato gratin,
yes.
but with onions and anchovies. But it's sprats, isn't it? It's not what we know of as anchovies.
No, and they're pickled with sort of allspice and sherry, and it's a very sweet pickle again. So they're totally different in flavour than the Mediterranean ones in olive oil. It's a deep umami flavour again, isn't it? We made the comparison to Japanese food earlier on, and it has that umami, the depth of sort of fermentation and soy sauce-like flavours in it. They're perhaps not what children easily take to.
No, it's not. And one thing that I find increasingly interesting about Swedish cooking is the use of spice as well, because people don't necessarily think of Scandinavian food as being spicy. And it's not spicy in the sense that it's hot or warm. There's very little chilli that gets used. But if you think about the range of spices that are used in Swedish cooking in particular, you have allspice, which is hugely popular, caraway, cumin, saffron, star anise, cinnamon, and cardamom. Cardamom, all these spices, they really take front and centre of Swedish cookery.
Absolutely.
And people don't necessarily think of Scandinavian cookery as being highly spiced. But actually, if you think about how much spice is used... It's very pervasive.
And they're very warming spices, not in the sense of heat themselves, but just warming, aren't they? And in a sense, healing. healing spices.
Yeah, they do. They have that. I mean, cinnamon has that. It always makes me think of Christmas. Yeah, but it is such it does. It makes you feel comforted, doesn't it? Especially when it's paired with things like sweetness or rice pudding. Rice pudding is a real memory of mine. You know what it's like? You come home from school at 4 o'clock and you're absolutely ravenous. Mm. And I have very, very fond memories of a rice pudding just being ready at the time that we got in through the door at school. And it was the first thing we had. It was a way to stop us getting grumpy and tired. It's like, here's a bowl of rice pudding with some cinnamon on it, and now you can get on with the rest of your day.
There's a lovely Swedish name, actually, for it, mellanmål, which it actually translates as between meals. And the Italians have the same, una merenda, which is exactly that. And we don't quite have that. You know, we would just refer to a snack quite generically, but that kind of between meals, and it would be considered a poor household that doesn't supply their child with that when they come back from school.
I never knew that was a cultural thing, and I think that's a fabulous idea, that there needs to be something to make sure the children don't get hangry at 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock, whenever. But then I think the whole Swedish day is kind of wrapped up in these little traditions. If you think about the tradition of fika, which is the social necessity to provide your guests with coffee and usually something sweet.
Yes, and usually something home-baked. You know, it wouldn't do to go out and buy a pack of biscuits. It would have to be something home-baked. Mm. And there's lots of quick ways of baking in Sweden. I guess almost, you know, you watch somebody walk down the street and you think, oh my goodness, I better put something in the oven. And there are, like a rolltårta, you know, there are cakes that literally take 10 minutes and you throw that together. And I think the cinnamon buns are obviously very much part of that. Every household would bake their own version of them. At Christmas, it would be this, again, going back to spice, the saffron buns.
Yeah.
It's so essential to sort of 3 o'clock in the afternoon type snack again, isn't it?
And fika, my understanding of it is that it's a very informal but formal arrangement. So it's an informal arrangement in the sense that people don't phone up and say, I'm popping around for a cup of coffee. They will turn up on your doorstep, but there is an expectation that you will be able to provide and some sort of hospitality.
Absolutely. And you say that. I've had many a conversation with people since moving to the UK. I'm just going to jump on the board here. This is no offence meant, but English people are quite funny in the sense that you need to call them to say you're coming over. Whereas at home, you drive past, you think, I'll just pop in.
Yeah.
We can have a glass of wine, or we'll have a beer, or we'll just have a cup of tea or something. No one ever rings and says, I'm coming over. It's all very informal. And no one says, no, sorry, you can't come in. Everyone's just come in, it doesn't matter what the house looks like, no one cares. But here I found you need to call someone to give them warning that you're coming over. It's funny.
So you think maybe it's British people that are the weirdos in this?
I wouldn't necessarily say weirdos. I wouldn't like the whole nation to go against me, but I definitely think that they like to be prepared slightly more.
I think the other thing that's very indicative of cuisine from Sweden is, and it's shown here, is the use of acid. That continued use of acid as a counterpoint to some slightly richer, more robust flavours. The way that I've always cooked, whether it's a starter or a main course or in some cases a dessert, I always want to know where the acid is coming from. And I think acid helps to balance a dish so well, especially with fish. But with something like this, it's so important. We've got this rich, slightly gamey meat, a touch of spice from the juniper, but then we have this very rich mayonnaise. But running through that, you have gurka, silver skin onions. Yeah. And I think that's something that's very characteristic of Scandinavian food, just in general.
You know, that is so to the point, because we often look for that too, don't we? And we have conversations where we taste the dish we're going to put on and we will say it lacks some sort of acidity, or it could be sugar as well. You know, my grandmother very much taught me that the three things she always had by her stove was salt and pepper and sugar, and often adding just a pinch of sugar to a savoury dish and vice versa. And it would just lift it, even with a tiny amount. And we often find that too, I think, that we have talks about adding the acidity, and all our dishes are underpinned by acidity, I would say.
Yeah, but we do like a bit of salt, don't we?
Yes, we do like a bit of salt. We do taste it with salt.
That was Tina Roche and Liz Young from Cambridge Cookery and Bistro talking to chef and MasterChef finalist Alex Rushmer about, well, about food, about eating food, about its influences on their lives. And you can follow Alex on Twitter. His handle is justcookit. That's all one word. Whilst Tina and Liz's website is cambridgecookery.com. And that music signals time for the latest food tweets from the city.
Yes, and a lot of them are about drinking Guinness and things, strangely enough. For example, Calverley's Brewery in Hooper Street are saying that their porter and stout is pouring very nicely today. Mm. Brewboard in Harston has tweeted to say they're open from 2 o'clock till 6 o'clock this afternoon for pints by the Woodburner. And Rory McGrath would like everyone to know that he's enjoying the first of the black stuff at the Blue Ball in Grantchester right now. In addition, Steak and Honour are open today from 11:30 until 10 o'clock tonight. And Allotment Cafe, who we'll hear from shortly, have just delivered some bread to, well, you'll hear about where to in the interview.
It's been 2 years since Flavour chatted to Katie Moore of the Allotment Cafe, just as she was starting out, in fact. It has its name because of some of the food she uses are grown on her allotment. Grace Campling has been back to see how the business has developed.
So I'm here with Katie from Allotment Cafe.
Hello, Hello. Grace.
So tell us about Allotment Cafe. We talked to you about 2 years ago on Flavour. For those that don't know what it is, just maybe the vision of your company and what you do and when it started.
Yeah, so I spoke to you guys a couple of years ago when I had really just started and I was doing a pop-up at Novi. So I was there a few days a week cooking like lunch, brunch food and cakes. And that was really opened so many doors for me. It was through there that the girls at the larder got in touch and wanted to start doing wholesale stuff for them. And it's just kind of snowballed from there. I can't really believe that it's been 2 years, but at this point I'm really happy with where we are. We're doing a lot of wholesale, which is great. There's some really lovely independent shops around Cambridge, so it's a joy to be able to stock them. And then doing a lot of private catering and corporate catering, which is great. It's my kind of food. It's the food that I want to eat at lunchtime. It's fresh sourdough sandwiches, delicious salads, and actually it's just something a little bit different to what you'd normally have at your desk.
I was gonna say, what do you think that the Allotment Cafe brings to Cambridge that is different to what you'd normally see in the kind of foodie circuit of Cambridgeshire?
We're not reinventing the wheel, certainly, but what we do is just make sure that everything is done with love and with care and time. Everything is handmade and it's made fresh every day. So whether that's, you know, the bread itself, which has been a labour of love over many years, right through to all of our dressings and condiments and that kind of thing. We just want to know what's in our food and we want to know where it comes from. And I think you can taste that. I think that, you know, shortening that supply chain makes a big difference in the final product.
So you've just recently employed your first employee.
Yes.
And that's a massive step for the business.
It was, yeah.
And so what was it like from being solo mission for 2 years to now having somebody in with new ideas and a new voice?
It's great. It's a breath of fresh air, actually. The business had got to a point where it was on that cusp of being just too much for one person. And I was very aware that if I wanted things to progress and to expand, I needed to take on someone else because there's only so much you can do as one human. A gift from the gods, my wonderful colleague Alice got in touch with me just before Christmas, and she has incredible culinary training and also business training, so she was just kind of a second me, which is exactly what I wanted. So between us, we have managed to grow a lot this year. Just having two extra hands has made a huge difference. You know, obviously I was kind of anxious to share something that has been mine for so long, but she's been incredibly respectful of everything and just brought some fresh life to it, which is amazing. She's a godsend. what's the question?
How has your range developed and how do you like view your food nowadays?
So I think the food has generally improved, and I think that is a lot to do with practice. And I think that I've just become increasingly obsessed with trying to use British things wherever possible, whether that's through produce, which is kind of a given, but you know, through to everything, through to your grains and your pulses, you can source most things from the UK. All of our flour is sourced from Cambridgeshire. And I just really love having that connection to the food. And I think that means that you take more care in how you use it. And so we're keen to continue to do more and always be better at sourcing our produce. And hopefully it will continue to improve rather than deteriorate in the coming years.
Yeah.
For me, the joy is as much in actually growing things as in the sort of luxury of being able to use locally sourced produce. It's such a sort of base privilege, just growing something from seed.
And well, that leads me quite nicely on to, we've actually got Dave Fox, who is from the Trumpeter Allotment Society.
Yeah, amazing.
And he's going to be talking about like what you should be planting at the moment,
yes,
what you should be, what you'll be collecting at the moment,
yeah,
what's in season. So how about you? How is your food going to change going into spring? What are we going to see coming out of your allotment?
Well, this is always, I find this is the trickiest part of the year, because you're kind of over your winter produce, but you're sowing your things for summer, so you're kind of got all these visions of tomatoes and salad crops, but you're not quite there yet. So we're still harvesting like the last of the kales and cavolo nero. We've got some lovely kalets and bits and bobs which are going into salads at the moment, but also we are now sowing all of our crops for the summer, so all of those delicious tomatoes and courgettes and aubergines, and so there is light at the end of the tunnel. The root veg is slowly being phased out.
From when you started to where you are now, could you have predicted that you'd be at this point?
That's a really good question. I don't think I necessarily knew where I'd end up or what points I'd hit along the road when I first started. I guess back at the beginning, my dream was to have a cafe or a bakery. But as the, you know, path has gone on, I'm actually really, really happy being sort of behind the scenes and being able to just do wholesale and private events, which I love. And it means that everything is different and you get to work with a lot more interesting people. Every week is different. You never know what's going to come up. And it's really tough having a bricks and mortar space. And I think especially as an independent, there are a lot of things that you have to take into consideration. And so for me at that, like at this point, I'm actually really thrilled with where we are and how much we've progressed. And I'm not saying never that I'll have a cafe, but for now, I'm really happy.
How would you advise anybody that wanted to start it out, who wasn't classically trained?
Yeah.
As a chef?
I would say think really hard about it to start with, because it's long hours and it's can be quite full on. But if you love it, it doesn't feel like work. For me, one of the things over the past couple of years that has been invaluable is doing work experience with other chefs and other bakers that I really admire. Immersing yourself in an environment that is completely about food and is built by people who love food is a fantastic way to decide whether or not it's for you.
Right.
Just get out there, start making food for people, send out sample boxes, create an Instagram page, start conversations with other people in the local area. And if it's good, then word of mouth will start to do the work for you.
And finally, just say once again, where can we find your grub?
So you can find our food every week at the larder at Burwash Manor, at Cakes at Novi, at Bradmore Farm Shop. We've just started stocking our bread there. Country Kitchen in Hazelfield and the Moringa Tree use our bread as well. And if you want to get in touch, the best way is either on Instagram or via our email address, which is hello@allotmentcafe.com.
Perfect. Well, thanks so much for talking
Thank
to
you,
me.
Thank you, Grace. It was a pleasure.
Totally. Cheers.
Cheers.
And that was Katie Moore of the Allotment Cafe.
Now, we last featured Restaurant 22 on Chesterton Road back in June 2017. And since then, the owner Armando Tommaso has decided to move on to other things. But this left a chance for a young couple to take the reins. It's been all over social media the last few weeks as high-profile chef Sam Carter and his fiancée Alexandra picked up the keys. And they've been rushing around getting everything just so for the big opening next week.
We only have one focus at the minute, and that's getting Restaurant 22 the best it can be.
You're going to be open on the 24th of March?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Dan Smith, who was formerly the sommelier at Alimentum, he's coming on board with us too.
Lee, who was sous chef here before, he's coming back and he's joining us as well.
Between us, we've got the experience to take it forward.
We want to make this special.
This is the beginning of a new era for mankind.
It's good.
So this is our main restaurant. And we've also got the private dining room upstairs. Lovely wooden floor underneath three layers of carpet. And we've tried to keep the original features. So we've got the stained glass windows. We've got brass light fittings down here.
I'd never actually been in here back when it was Restaurant 22.
Right.
But all I knew was everything was very thick carpeting, thick velvet curtains as well. It's intimate, I suppose.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
We're not trying to change it. We're trying to sort of modernise it slightly. Still keep the intimacy, the romanticness and everything like that. So we've kept the brass light fittings. We've gone new paintwork. Stained glass windows, they're beautiful.
and they're not going anywhere, so they've just been cleaned up.
Because anybody who's looked at the articles online will know that this is a converted Victorian house.
Yeah.
I think in terms of it operating as a restaurant, it's actually older than you guys, isn't it?
It was converted in 1982, we think. Ah. There's some etchings on the stained glass window at the front that have 1982 as the date. So we believe that when it was first converted to dining rooms, that etching was put on. So yes, it has been a restaurant longer than we've been on the planet, I suppose.
I would love to go back to the old house.
Fireplace, so it's a bioethanol fireplace going in there.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah. Which sort of give off a nice light, nice bit of heat as well in the winter.
So this is the main area where people will be seated. This area does seat about, is it 20 people?
20 to 22, depending on how many tables we've got. We're going to try and do the small tables down here, and any of the larger bookings, we've got the private dining rooms. So this is Chesterton room. We've got...
Wow, I feel that carpet. Sorry, I just... Yeah.
Brand new carpet. 12 is a recommended number. The idea of a pier is bespoke menus, graduation, dinners, birthdays, christenings, small weddings possibly.
Yeah.
So your favourite food might be scallop, beef, souffle. And that's what we'll do. And we'll just use seasonal products and create a menu to work with.
You'll be head chef here. There'll be a team of chefs, I suppose, to accommodate everybody.
I've got myself head chef. I've got a sous chef moving down from Edinburgh. He's got a really good background. So he's been at Tom Aikins, Ted Sawyer in Australia. I met him working for Gordon Ramsay in London.
Ramsay's attempt at relaxing the staff isn't working.
How old are you?
24.
24. You can't cook an artichoke? What's going on in your mind? Tell me then. Can't keep up. Why are you wiping the plates? What's he doing, Mark, that jerk? Concentrate on keeping your job.
Well, stay here. Every time there's food on the pass,
It was a tough environment, very demanding, high pressure. The restaurant that was at Mays, it was Michelin star, but it was high volume as well.
Mm.
And just off Oxford Street, I mean, we were sort of 120 for lunch, 140 for dinner. And it's still keeping that Michelin star standard that obviously Jason Atherton created. And then it just carried on from there, and working at that intensity with those standards. I mean, it's a brilliant place to learn.
I remember the hours that Sam was doing at that time. It was just incredible. But he did so much and learned so much there. I think those lessons will stick with you forever. You really cut your teeth there, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a great learning environment, and working with some of the chefs in that kitchen, incredible chefs. And obviously, if you surround yourself by talented people, you pick up their skills, and that's definitely what we did. At the time, there was a great team there, and I'm still in touch with a lot of them. Andy, our sous chef, I met him there, and definitely worth it. I'd definitely do it again.
So there's the link, because otherwise it always amazes me the distance people are prepared to travel to work with each other.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah,
cool.
I think the thing with the industry is you make good friends. You spend more time with fellow chefs than you do with your family or with your normal friends.
Yeah.
So we were working long days. All my time at Gordon Ramsay, I've got friends for life from there. And then I gave him a call when we found out about this place, and he was happy to move down from Edinburgh. So he starts on the 19th and we open on the 24th.
I'd love to do it, and you know you've always had it coming.
Is it a young man's game in that kind of high-pressured environment?
I think so. It's physically demanding, it's mentally demanding. I think it probably is a young man's game, yeah. I think it has to be. But saying that, there's guys out there that love it. People in their 60s and 70s, and they're still doing the hours. And
as you said it, you said exactly the phrase I was looking for, which is where age is almost irrelevant when you've got that desire and that passion.
Of course.
It's like an addiction almost, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
The kitchen is, the buzz of the kitchen.
It goes further than the kitchen. I mean, the restaurant industry, there's sommeliers, there's restaurant managers, there's restaurateurs. I mean, it's a bug, and I think you're never going to make a huge profit from it, but I think having your own restaurant is something that we're really looking forward to, and if you don't want to do it, then people will soon leave, but I think we're definitely committed to it, and hopefully we're going to make a success of it.
Hello, may I help you?
Hi, I'm Abe Froman. Party of three for 12.
You're going to be front of house, Alex.
Yes, I am, yeah. Just a bit of a change from being behind my desk all day. But I'm really looking forward to it. I can't wait. And also to be serving the wine too. I'm really looking forward to it.
Alex is on the end of the phone if anyone wants to book a table. And
absolutely.
There's the email, and there's some sample menus on our holding page. Oh. So, yeah. Our a la carte menu, which is a very small a la carte menu. So it's a three starters, three mains and three desserts. But the idea of keeping it small is keeping it fresh and keeping it regularly changing, weekly, if not bi-weekly.
Yeah.
And it's going to be completely seasonal. So wild garlic, the different mushrooms, the asparagus coming into season, sort of April time. And that's the idea of it. We will also be doing a set lunch menu because Restaurant 22 has never been open at lunchtimes before. We have put together a set menu, which is three courses for £20. And the idea is to offer that and hopefully get a bit of business and trade at lunchtime, which is what it's never had here before. And then we're also going to be running a five-course tasting menu and a seven-course tasting menu. Yeah. The seven-course tasting menu is £45 and the five-course is £35.
So we offer the five-course tasting menu from Tuesday to Thursday and then the seven-course tasting menu on Fridays and Saturday nights. So the idea is that you might not have as much time during the week, but on the weeknights, you can come and have a delicious, decadent seven-course taste menu. And the set lunch menu is all through the week, and the a la carte menu is both lunchtime and dinner all through the week. So we're trying to include something for everyone, really, and make sure that if you do just want to come for dinner on a Tuesday night, you can just come and have a main off the a la carte menu. So that's the idea.
Borlick, fix us some coffee, will you?
How did you find out about this place? Are you friends with Armando?
A lot of people have said the same. Restaurant 22 in Cambridge has got a really good reputation.
Yeah.
But we didn't know anything about it. We sort of drove past it 100 times before realising about it. And then we actually came in for dinner after finding it online. Got in touch with Armando and we sort of managed to sell. So, yeah, that's how it came about. But not a lot of people do know about Restaurant 22. I mean, it's... We're starting to get our social media out there, the Twitter, the Facebook, Instagram. I think people are starting to hear about it and, Restaurant 22, and it's got a good reputation, but I didn't know where it was. And
So
we want to put it on the map a little bit more and we want to make it accessible to everybody.
We found that there's quite a few people that do know about it, though, and who really love it.
Yeah.
We spoke to a lady the other day who had a wedding reception here, like 10 or 15 years ago, and people have really special memories because it's that kind of special place. So we want all those people to come back and see the revamped version and hopefully they'll enjoy it as much as they have done before. So listen up.
So listen up. We moved to Cambridge 3 years ago.
Yeah.
I was working in London, like commuting. I don't think we'd move from Cambridge now.
No.
I think it's got everything that we want. It's a little bit more laid back than London. It's got all the offers that London has. I mean, you've got restaurants, you've got pubs, you've got bars, you've got everything. I'm pretty settled here, to be honest, so it's good.
You mentioned that you started working in the pubs and cooking around about 13, 14 years old.
Mm.
Are you the first in your family to have done that?
I started washing up and working in pubs. My mum and dad never really used to cook that much.
If your mum heard you say that...
If she heard that now, she'd probably be quiet.
Yeah.
She started cooking now. And she's pretty good.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that so she hears.
Yeah.
She's pretty good. But no, I just started working in pubs and just love the atmosphere, love the environment. Every chef starts off being a kitchen porter, I think. And then, just love the buzz of the restaurant and the pub. And
your cooking will be ostensibly British?
Absolutely British. It's difficult to say exactly what style and stuff like that. Mm. And everyone says, have you got a favourite dish or anything like that? It's just a real emphasis on seasonal, local where possible. The biggest thing for me is, like, don't put anything in your mouth unless it's
delicious.
Full of flavour and delicious.
Yeah.
And that's what we want to do. We want to make people leave and go, wow, that tasted good.
Mm.
But that's all I want to do. And you want to obviously provide the service and everything like that.
Yeah, just make it a really friendly, lovely atmosphere. We want people to feel special when they come here. We feel honoured. We've had people say, it's my partner's birthday or it's our graduation or wedding anniversary. And it's a real privilege for us to have those people here and choose here to celebrate. So we want to make sure they love it, they have a great time. And Sam's food really is delicious as well. That's his main thing. That's true.
Alex and Sam, it's been great catching up with you.
Thank you.
I'm sure it'll be a fantastic opening night. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio. Yeah, don't wait. Others haven't, and Alex told me recently they're fully booked for that opening night on the 24th of March, but they are taking bookings for the 27th. Their menu is up on their site now, that's restaurant22.co.uk, or you can call Cambridge 351 880 to book.
I'm free.
And here's news of the free food available now in Cambridge, which you can find on the Olio app.
Yeah, we've got time for a couple. If strawberry balsamic vinegar is your bag, then you can get some from the Arbury area. But if you're more into Alpro soya milk, then you need to head to Sawston. Both of those are free. And if you haven't got the Olio app, you can download that free as well.
On now to advice if you're growing your own fruit and vegetables. Earlier in the week, it was a bit warmer, so Alan went along to Trumpington Allotments to get some tips from Dave Fox and to see if the overwinter crops had survived.
Well, Dave, after a long, hard winter, which I think isn't quite over, back on the allotment. Much damage from frost?
Some. We're looking at a salad bed where there's 30 or so quite healthy-looking young lettuces. These were covered by a fleece during the very cold snap. You can see that damage on some of the leaves, but anyway, this is a hardy type. I mean, these plants have all got antifreeze in them, so they're okay.
Yeah. Right, and you've still got a lot of leeks here.
Well, they're rather sad, actually. I mean, they look okay from here, but when you harvest them and prepare them for use in the kitchen, we find the Allium leaf miner has burrowed down through the stem and pupated towards the bottom of the stem, and that causes quite a lot of damage, so there's not all of the stem is usable. You spend a lot of time in the kitchen cutting out the bad bits, so that's a bit annoying, so that's really why I haven't got around to harvesting a lot of those. We are going to have to face up to the Allium leaf miner this year, so we're well prepared here at Trumpington Allotments. We've got a lot of enviro mesh, we've got a big roll of it to sell to the tenants. Hopefully that will keep the fly off.
All right, is that a common fly?
No, well, it is now. It certainly was here last year. Yeah. But it's only been in the UK for, I don't know, 15 years or something, so it's not found all parts. So I think it's caught gardeners by surprise. I mean, we've had leek moth for quite a while now, but Allium leaf miner is a new one. Yeah. It has the same sort of modus operandi, you know, and you spot some symptom in the leaves of the onions first, and if you don't do anything about it, then the larva just pupate towards the bulb of the plant, which then ultimately rots, and yeah, it's not good. You're never going to get a good onion out of it.
Right. So. And I suppose being down there in the bulb of the plant is protecting it from some of the cold weather we've had.
Absolutely,
as well.
Yeah, well, that's right. It's a great strategy for an insect. Yeah,
right. But so this is a problem that's likely to stay with us then, unless we use the mesh.
We don't know, because of course at last we've had a proper cold snap, which has hopefully killed off slugs and pupating pests by their trillions in our soil. Let's just hope so. So it could be that the leaf miner is not a native. Maybe it's a bit temperature sensitive. I don't know anything about it. But I mean, the pupae are in the bulbs, and then as they mature, I think they probably just end up in the soil. So if the frost, I mean, that was a hard frost that went deep down. So hopefully it's frozen the little things, and maybe we won't have any problem at all this year. In which case, the tenants will come back to us and say, why were you charging us £2 a metre for that environment? We didn't need it, but anyway. Anyway, that's going to be my method from now on for all onions and leeks. On sowing, they're going to be covered by EnviroMesh autumn or spring, because they're the sowing times for these things. Mm. This bed's actually where beetroot is going to go, so that's one of the crops that we want to get in fairly early if conditions are adequate. And the bed here is mulched, so what the first thing to do is to move the mulch off the bed. What we're hoping to find under here is some very well rotted mulch at the bottom, which we call compost, and not too many weeds.
How long has this mulch been here?
It's got
it is well rotted.
Yeah, it's got some old grass clippings in it, so it's probably possibly from late summer.
Yeah,
so nice dark soil, no weeds, with the fertility already partly incorporated into it by worms, so I'll just move the rest of the mulch off and then till it with the miller tool. We'll use one of those in a minute on another bed.
A miller tool.
So this is like a little mini handheld plough sort of, so it's got some toothed wheels and also a hoe dragging behind. So you can move it back and forth across the soil, and it just cultivates a couple of centimetres depth.
Right.
And So if there are any little weeds germinating in there, that'll have killed them.
So if by chance you didn't have a miller tool, you could, what, use a hoe or a...
Yeah, use a hoe, yeah. Break off the loose material like and, yeah, a hoe, because we don't want to go too deep. This is surface cultivation only. And I should say that the miller tool is not suitable for most soils. It only works on a light, sandy loam like we have here at Foster Road Allotment. So several people here use them, but certainly if you've got a clay loam, don't.
They'll just clog up, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely won't work. So we're lucky here. There's probably other methods that work there. So then we'll leave this bed for a couple of weeks. That's the stale seed bed technique. And then hoe off again using the miller tool. And then we've hopefully got a bed where all the weed seeds near the surface have germinated and been killed off, and then our beetroot has a clear run to get started before weeds start growing again. So anyway, that's the first stage of preparing a seed bed, is getting the mulch off and then giving it a little run over with surface cultivation. I can show you a bed where I did that. This bed has had the mulch removed yesterday and actually had some of this grow organic fertiliser, which is composted, stabilised farmyard manure. So that's really, really good stuff. Bit cheating not using my own compost, but you never make your own compost. So here we go. Good few handfuls of that incorporated into the surface. And that's going to be a bed for onions. So I'll leave that for... I really want to get the onions in as soon as possible, but I'll leave that for another at least a week, ideally 2 weeks, because we're doing a stale seedbed. And then hoe it off again, and then put the onion sets. We'll go in here, and of course, what comes after the onion sets? The EnviroMesh, just in case the allium leaf miner's already on the wing. And then behind us, we have a bed here, where I've recently raked off the mulch, and you can see there's quite a lot of organic matter on the surface there. And what do you think I'm going to sow here, Alan?
Parsnips.
Yeah, these
yes,
are parsnips.
Right,
so
these
are the last of last year's parsnips, which are already they disappear in the depths of winter, parsnips. So you need to know where they are so you can dig them up. But in March, the leaf is already in growth, and that means that the root is past its prime. It's starting to create the flower spike and make leaves. And it thinks it's going to make nice flowers and seeds. It's wrong. Because that's going to get dug up. That's going to get dug up today. So that's a little rule of thumb I've got: is the last parsnips come out on the day the first parsnips get sown.
Yes,
it's a year long.
It's
vegetable.
A long life cycle. Actually.
It is. Yeah, it's a year long vegetable. Yeah, I suppose it's by definition it's the longest annual vegetable. I suppose.
Yes.
Cauliflowers might take a bit longer. Yeah. So we've got parsnips finishing in one bed, and then on the adjacent bed, because I have this
your rotation
system. Yeah. That's where the parsnip seed's going to go. So it's going to, ideally I would leave this for a couple of weeks to again let the weed seeds germinate and then hoe the weeds off before putting the parsnip in, but I really want to crack on.
Yeah.
It's warmed up a lot. We've lost that time because of the cold snap, which is when ideally I would have done the seed bed technique in February, but we couldn't. So I want to get some parsnips in. It's a little bit dicey putting things in this early because of course the weather could turn again. I do two beds of parsnips each year, so I've got a little bit of assurance there. If you've got a smaller garden, just sow half the parsnips and then put the next half in a month later.
Yeah.
And then if the first half do fail, then you could get one last sowing in, or maybe do carrots instead, something that doesn't take quite as long as a parsnip, so you can still have a bed full of umbellifer roots.
Mm-hmm.
The parsnip seeds are quite small, so I want to be able to create a fine tilth, as it says on the seed packet, and get them in a nice straight line. And the reason I want them in a very straight line is to facilitate weed control by hoeing later on.
It's not worth taking a fortnight to warm the soil with a black cover or anything like that before putting parsnips.
Oh, yes, it would be. That would be great.
Like
But they've got, they need quite a long growing season, so I want to get some in now and just hope that it's warm enough for them to germinate.
Yeah. So once you've got this prepared satisfactorily, what, do you put a line out or something?
Yeah, I'll stretch a double line about 30 centimetre gap between them, and then draw a hoe along the straight line to make a, a little called a drill, a little V-shaped hole, and then I shall put the parsnip seed in there, and also some radish seeds. I'll put three parsnip seeds at one station, and then a few radishes, and then maybe 5 to 10 centimetres long another parsnip, and then some radishes and so on. And we've mentioned it before, that's a way of showing us where the parsnips are before they actually germinate, because the radishes do come up early. And it's a great technique, because it means you remember to say radishes. But if you incorporate them into the cultivation of parsnips, also carrots as well, they could use markers for other things, then you get a few radishes before the main crop comes up.
Yeah, good. Right, well, thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
And Dave Fox will be back in today's news section too, with details of some classes.
And there's Green Onions signalling that this is the news section, and we shall begin with jobs.
Sam Carter, who we heard earlier, is looking for a kitchen porter at Restaurant 22 in Chesterton Road. Contact him via Twitter for details at samcarter_22.
Mill Road Butchers is looking for an experienced full-time butcher and also for part-time staff. Email your CV to cambridgemillroadbutchers@gmail.com.
Today is the start of the Thriplow Daffodil Weekend, with food vans in attendance. Entrance is £8 for adults and £4 for children aged 5 to 16.
Dave Fox is running a couple of Grow Your Own sessions for people wanting to take up food and vegetable growing.
We're resuming the Grow Your Own sessions at my allotment Saturday the 24th of March, and again on Saturday the 7th of April. And this is a free session where you come and help me on my allotment, and I show you how to do it, or you show me how to do it, or perhaps we learn from each other. And although you do some work for me, it's not for free, because you'll go away with some veg. So all the details of these sessions are on the Transition Cambridge website. 10 o'clock sharp, right. Finish before lunch.
At the Kingston Arms in Kingston Street, there's a new chef, and the new menu starts on Monday, so the kitchen will be opening at 5 p.m, not at noon for that day only, to allow extra preparation time.
Black Cat Cafe in Mill Road has reopened after its refurbishment.
This coming Wednesday at the Queen's Head in Newton, the street food is provided by Uncle G's Buttermilk Gluten-Free Chicken. That's from 6 to 8.30-ish, and the week after, it's the Wandering Yak.
The next food market at Newnham Bakery Cafe in Derby Street will be on the 25th of March from 11 till 4. Hum clothes and cheeses and wines will be on sale.
Over Village has a regular market. If you're a food producer from within a 30-mile radius of Over and would like a stall, contact info@overvillagemarket.co.uk.
Slow Food Anglia is setting up a slow food group in Cambridge. As part of this, they are having an aperitif evening at Thirsty in Chesterton Road on the 5th of April between 6 and 9 p.m. There'll be a talk at 7 p.m. If you'd like to attend, RSVP info@slowfoodanglia.org.
Aromi in Bennett Street is staying open until 10 p.m. on Fridays and Saturdays for meals now.
On 1st of April at Cambridge Wine Merchants in Cherry Hinton Road, Quirico Tapas has Sunday tapas from 12.30 to 3.30, suitable for all the family. Details on the Cambridge Wine Merchants website or via Eventbrite.
And on the 12th of April from 7 to 9 p.m. at Thirsty in Chesterton Road, there will be a tasting of German wines with food pairings, and tickets are £29 from Eventbrite, and the name of the event is Das Weinfest Tasting.
A reminder that Eat Cambridge's festival programme will be available in 2 weeks' time, and that's when we'll all be able to start booking tickets for fringe events. Everything will be on the website eatcambridge.co.uk. The programme will include a full list of all stall holders for the main event on Saturday the 19th of May, plus the final lineup for the food and drink talks at that event, which will be hosted by Rosie Sykes, ex-executive head chef at Pint Shop. And there's no need to book for the main event, so you can get that in the diary now. And we'll have an exclusive preview on the next flavour from Heidi White. And I think we've just got a little bit of time to talk about another festival, which is the Cambridge Science Festival that's on, and a couple of things which are of particular interest there. Next Friday, the 23rd of March, Insects, the World's Weirdest Food. BBC gastronaut Stephen Gates uses rockets, flatulence, honey and sweets to take you on a rip-roaring adventure through the world of edible insects. And on the 24th of March, the Science of Ice Cream, both at the Cambridge Science Festival.
And that's all we have time for today.
If you want to get in touch with any of the news or comments when we're off air, you can email us flavour@cambridge105.co.uk, or you can contact us on Twitter at flavour105. Well, that's all from us, and we will be back on the 31st of March. So until then, it just remains for Alan and Sue and myself to say goodbye.
Goodbye.